Father in heaven, we bend the knee to you knowing that everything that we have comes from you. We have nothing, even the breath in our lungs, except that you've given it to us, even the next breath that comes. We ask, Lord, that you would use us according to your purpose, because you've raised us up out of the dust of the earth, Lord, and stamped your image upon each and every one of us for a purpose. And we ask, Lord, that we would fulfill your purpose by you guiding us into it, by you shedding light upon us, and by you embracing us with your love, Lord. That you would gather us together as a church, Lord, to do mighty things in thee, and to reflect your glory by our love for one another. We ask, Lord, that you would illuminate your word further today, and we would understand some of the deeper, more complex issues relating to it and its application to modern society, Lord, the world in which we live, which lies in darkness. In your Son's name we ask these things. Amen. I guess we'll start in Job 38.
Don't throw me dead and yeti and start talking.
This is the beginning, everyone knows it, famous response that Job finally gets out of God after Job spent quite some time arguing with his buddies over an ash heap. And then finally, God speaks. Of the four individuals that dealt with Job, his three older buddies were wrong. They got everything wrong. You know, they inferred from Job's condition that he must have sinned, and it wasn't the case. And Elihu, the young guy who finally speaks in chapters 35 and 36, he actually doesn't get rebuked by God. Apparently everything that Elihu said is correct. But what's interesting is what God has to say when he starts his discussion, and I want to see if there's something we might be able to extract further from it that has implications for us. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge?" It's an interesting question, isn't it? It means that by adding words for things that you don't absolutely know for a fact, and they were just speculating the whole time, right? That you are darkening counsel. That is, you, instead of adding to illumination and understanding in the midst of the people in which you're speaking, you are actually making it more inaccessible. You are driving the truth farther from everyone's grasp. And consequently, a falsehood is substituted for it. In other words, you've been substituting falsehoods for the truth and misrepresenting me. When you say darkeneth counsel, it means even the direction and the advice to be taken is harmful and misrepresentative of God. Because they were talking about who? God. God's actions in relationship with Job. So they're talking about God's actions and what God's all about, God's motivations, why God does things. We're in Job 38, the first few verses right now. Just, you're not, hardly missed anything, I hope. Hope that's the case. Of course, if the first 3 minutes was the best, we're in big trouble, right? But both the bishops are in trouble and I'm in trouble, so. But everyone else got it. So consequently, darkening counsel is a dangerous thing. And notice how it proceeds, words without knowledge. You darken counsel with words without knowledge. So when people say, well, you know, a multitude of counselors, there's wisdom. Well, that would be the notion if one of the people in the group has wisdom. The likelihood is the guy with wisdom is the one who's actually quoting God directly and correctly. I think that's important. Quote God directly, not indirectly, and quote him correctly, not incorrectly. Therefore, you will not have darkening of counsel. You will have truth and illumination and light. It says in, I think, Psalm 36, in thy light we see light. In other words, only as God illuminates is there any illumination for us on any matter. It's the psalmist's way of saying what Paul says, in him we live and move and have our being. So in thy light we see light. If you see anything at all, truthfully, it's because God has illuminated it supernaturally. And apart from God's light, everything that you see, however accurately it might look, is in darkness. And you can compound the darkness by adding words without knowledge. And we constitute the fear of the Lord as the beginning of knowledge. So we tie everything back together as a giant circle. What proceeds from God is light because he is light and there's no shadow of turning in him at all. But it's men who devise many variations and deflections from God's truth. Then he commands Job in verse 3, gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee and answer thou me. He's going to go ahead and pose a series of questions. It's truth or consequences, really. Basically, God's going to set down the notion that the person who can answer these questions has the right to stab his finger in God's chest and demand, what are you doing? But if you weren't there, and you can't say, you're barred from dragging God before the court, which Job and his friends were doing. They were indicting God. Not in the same sense that Satan was indicting Job, but not too much better. And here's the first question. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? Who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened, or who laid the cornerstone thereof, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who shut up the sea with doors that when it brake forth, as if it had issued out of the womb, when I made the cloud the garment thereof, and thick darkness a swaddling band for it, and break up for it my decreed place, and set bars and doors, and said, hitherto shalt thou come, but no further, and here shalt thou pry that thy proud waves be stayed. And it continues on, discussion about depths of hell, etc. But it's pretty clear he's going back to the very creation of the earth, and he's asking questions about, were you there when I did these things? If you have understanding, declare it. And of course, Job doesn't. Now, the reason I bring up this example is that modern man is in the opinion that he can now answer all positively to these questions that God posed. Yeah, we know exactly what happened back then. Sure. There's no mystery about any of this, and therefore we certainly are in a position to indict you. Because man, by his searching, evidently or makes the allegation or the accusation that he has all this covered, that he has an entire cosmology and cosmogony. The difference between those two words. Besides the N and the L, there's a difference in meaning. There's the science study of the universe, and there's a study of the origin of the universe. So when you're talking about cosmogony, you want to know about its origin. And you're talking about the big debate. We should point out that evolution is not just biological evolution. There's also things like cosmic evolution. Not to mention the one that everyone's familiar with, but Darwin postulated. But what man now believes he's in the position to know authoritatively, or to the point where there's no doubt that the general idea is correct, is cosmogony. And therefore, the challenge that God gave to Job in the view of modern man is void. And that's simply something we have to reckon with. Either the challenge made to Job stands. And this is nothing more than men darkening counsel with words without knowledge. Or this is true, and the challenge to Job can be knocked on its can. And God can be deposed as someone who is not the only one holding the secret to these things. In fact, that defies Deuteronomy 29:29, doesn't it? It says the things that are revealed are for the sons of men, but the secret things belong to the Most High God. This is obviously in the category of secret things, else all that Job would have to do is quote scripture to the answer to these questions, and he couldn't. There is no scripture that answers these questions, except that God posed them rhetorically here because he knew the answers. And it takes the God who created it to know things that are hidden, right? When he says the secret things belong to the Most High God, it's because they're not accessible. They're not accessible other than God revealing it. And that's the beautiful thing about it, is there's a limit to what man can know. They say there's several ways that man can know something, right? Personal experience. These are the foundations of knowledge. External authority. Or testimony. Or revelation, usually meaning divine revelation. So So what happens is that these two things are the ground and foundation of the cosmogony, the modern secular cosmogony theories based on the Big Bang and things in this order. And so they argue from science, from what's known as methodological naturalism, that is the method of assuming the non-existence of God. Let me show you how that works. If I have a basic theory that rocks come from the earth, you know, that they're all created from earth, they start here, then I will hold that rocks do not come from the sky. Right? They come from down here, this direction. Rocks don't come from there. So therefore the source and origin of all rocks is here. Now, the fact that I come upon a meteorite, right, and I say it's from the earth, it's not because it's impossible that it came from the sky. It's because my views made it so that I would not see that possibility. See that? Clearly, we know that there are rocks that come from the sky. We have a name for them. But if we rule that out before we start studying rocks, then all rocks come from the earth, whether they came from the sky or not, and every rock we see is an earthbound terrestrial rock and not a meteorite. And so what is now deflecting the source of truth? It's the pre-commitment. We've ruled out something. And so, by definition, the modern sciences rule out any divine agency. And that's no different than saying rocks don't come from the sky. Because all rocks, therefore, come from the earth. So if you say all things that exist were made naturally through natural processes and we seek through nature to explain it, then you've ruled out God's agency by definition. And if you fail to rule out God's agency, you're not a scientist. Because the definition now of science has been subtly changed over this century specifically because of this creation-evolution debate from pursuit of the truth at all cost to a commitment to naturalism. In other words, the scientist is the one who rules out any divine revelation. The scientist is the one who throws this out. The scientist, therefore, is the one who believes that no rock comes from the sky. I use that example, obviously, because there's a time when people say rocks come from here. But there are rocks somewhere else, and sometimes they fall here. And they float around out in the solar system. So it's peculiar that man does, and I bring this up because I came across a very interesting exchange in, of all places, the Harvard Law Review, a very august publication, I'm sure you'd all agree. A gentleman named Lawrence Van Dyke reviewed a book on intelligent design in the Harvard Law Review, positively. Now, he's very fair because he knows the Harvard Law Review, and so he had to give both sides and explain, and he was very careful in how he put his words together. Name again, Lawrence Van Dyke. Well, off goes the review. It's published. Guess what happens? Professor Leiter at Harvard, professor of philosophy, writes a scathing attack letter. And in the letter, he's basically is saying that Van Dyke's career is torpedoed at this point. He said, this is the end of his academic career, and now that I'm going to expose him as the fraud that he is for not having exposed the intelligent design group as a bunch of frauds. And so he littered and riddled his attack with scholarly fraud, and therefore you can nail someone in Harvard for scholarly fraud. That's a legitimate reason to destroy someone's career. And so he made the charge over and over again that the brief book review of the Intelligent Design Group, and you remember they're the guys who put that video out that you saw. Remember that video way back? The Discovery Institute and Illustra Media do that video. And he made the mistake of reviewing a book by Francis Beckwith on the legal aspects of teaching intelligent design, because apparently intelligent design doesn't have the problem that creationism has in public schools. It seems to have, and that's a problem, isn't it? Because now it looks like creationism is sneaking in under the tent, right? Like a camel's nose, and so people like Leiter are willing to savage it in print, just to show how many. And actually, in the response of Leiter, it was fascinating because the quote from the writer, the reviewer, Van Dyke, was there is a significant controversy among a diverse minority of scientists about evolution. And he said a significant controversy among a diverse minority of dissidents, really, is basically saying. Diverse critics, that's what he said. Significant controversy among diverse critics of evolution. What Leiter cites is there is no significant controversy from scientists over the issue of evolution. So he recasts, and here it's in the Law Review, right? You can't get away with that kind of stuff in the Harvard Law Review, is repackaging someone's statements and misrepresenting them. Guess what that constitutes? Scholarly fraud. In fact, over and over again, Leiter proves Van Dyke's points left and right, that the evolutionists do in fact have a commitment to, and they do have a commitment to metaphysics, because the guy admits, yeah, when you accept evolution, then the entire metaphysical model falls out of it. Well, that's the only thing that Van Dyke was saying. So in point of fact, for all the foolishness of the Leiter's attack on intelligent design, he proved every point in Van Dyke's review. It's fascinating stuff.
So is his torpedo?
No, I don't think so. You know, what I thought was very funny about Lawrence Van Dyke when he responded to Dr. Leiter, he said, I'm not going to quote this right, but it was funny the way he said it. He said, I don't know if there are errors in my review, said, but after all, I'm human, and I assume there are there. But after reading Leiter's article, I'm sure that if they existed, he would not be capable of finding them. Because the things that he thought were errors were all factually true. Now,
is that trash talk?
Yeah, actually, there's a lot of trash talk between lawyers. It shouldn't surprise you that that's the case, right?
Why can't we all just get along?
Yeah, that works too, doesn't it?
This is so much more fun, though.
So, fascinating interchange between these guys. And I think the stakes are high. A lot of misrepresentation, because they're both calling each other liars. Fundamentally, as it boils down to, and they're both appealing to authorities. You know, no one's going to the divine revelation. In fact, the creationist movement has disavowed the intelligent design because they said they don't go far enough. They don't represent us. They keep God out. Essentially, they, you know, it's probably by design that they keep God out when they talk intelligent design. They just want to have a secular alternative, and that at least opens up the door to wider academic freedom for something other than evolution. And if that something other happens to be creationism, then it becomes a handmaiden of creationism indirectly, but be that as it may. Now, part of the lying is very interesting because, according to Leiter, there's not a single reputable scientist who's ever published in a refereed journal on the matter of intelligent design, not one. And he says, I only know two scientists who are even qualified in the intelligent design movement to even hold on to their doctorates, to which Van Dyke shows a list of 80 scientists, and he shows a list of 3 refereed scholarly journals just in the last year published in intelligent design. Not anything in Harvard Design, but major publications and journals like American Journal of Genetics and things like that, and Nature magazine. So he said, here you have, or Michigan University Press published a big whole book on it, refereed book, scholarly referees, before anything gets past Michigan University Press. Just came out this year, or late last year. I think it was December, January published. So how about this one? And Leiter's only comment in response was, I'm going to have to wait for someone else to get me off the hook on this one. I might have... Well, what happens now if you go from none to quite a few? You know, who's committing scholarly fraud? Who's trying to foist something on the public? You know? And so what you're going to get is this withering kind of ridicule because there is no foundation. In fact, that's what Van Dyke says. Where is the substantive attack on my review of the book? Not that I necessarily endorse everything in the book, but I'm open-minded enough to say there's something very wrong with evolution, and these guys have got something nailed here. And he threw out an interesting tidbit, which Leiter and no one else has challenged, in fact, is becoming kind of a big, serious issue in evolutionary genetics. You know what this tidbit is? I think it's fascinating. Tidbit is this. There has never been an example of the creation of new genetic information in any DNA in any creature ever. In other words, there is nothing that goes from an eyeless organ to an eye, or any not even a little piece of anything other than that was a duplicate codon that got accidentally moved from one place to another and got duplicated. Now, a duplication doesn't add information. If I have the Gettysburg Address on one sheet of paper, and I give you the same Gettysburg Address on another sheet of paper, do you have any more information you had when you had the first sheet? It's just a duplicate, right? So there's no more new information. It's still the Gettysburg Address. And if I clip out pieces of the Gettysburg Address and staple it and tape it on and glue it onto the other piece of paper, that doesn't mean any increase of information. Because what we do have evidence of is deterioration and loss of information. That we can show. We can show that something starts at a high complete standard of information content and can deteriorate through mutation. There's not a single example, and we've been looking for 40 years. And supposedly they can find it in fruit flies, in Drosophila melanogaster, the little fruit fly they've been irradiating with, that thing should be Godzilla by now, the amount of uranium they've exposed it to. But it's not. And what happens? We're not finding what evolution predicts, which is the expansion of information. Because to create a hand or an arm or something that didn't exist before, and even if it's just a minute change that they talk about, we would expect information increase. But we never see information increase. No, we don't see how that information can be created and then structured. It's proposed, but never been examined. So it fails the empirical test, doesn't it, so far? Now we can always say, one day they'll find that. But if you say, what is science? That's my big definition. This is where, for example, I would differ with Dr. Finkley. My view of science is the Baconian view. Science is that which can be empirically proven to be true. In other words, it can be reproduced in a laboratory experiment, and that is science. And you can extrapolate from the regularity. If I drop this pencil from this height, it keeps falling and hits the ground with a certain force. And I assume that if I do it 99 times, 100th time, it'll do the same thing. It won't float left and go up and pop in the wall over there. It'll drop. Because we talk about the regularity of science, which from a Christian point of view, we say it's because God imposes that law, order on the universe. There's a source for that law, that regularity. It's God himself. Otherwise, things would be chaotic. Everything seems to move with mathematical precision according to law. They say it just happened, and we say we don't think that's quite right. You can always point them back to Job 38 and say, where were you when foundations of the earth were laid, and they have a pretty good answer, they believe. And we would say, no, actually, we want to contend against that. So really, you're not going to win this war, because this Leiter's not convinced by Van Dyck's reply, nor is Van Dyck convinced by Leiter's shabby attack, drive-by, review, and attack.
Mark, but, I'm curious on something like that when two intellectuals are arguing.
In a big journal. That's the nice thing. It's exposed for everyone to see it at the Harvard Law Review.
Right, but I suspect there are very few people who are going to step up and say, wait a minute, I kind of agree with this Van Dyck, or at least I think we should think about it, because you can get hammered, right? They think, yeah, I might as well. This is the hill I want to die on, or I want to continue doing whatever it is I'm doing.
One of the things that the Leiter complained about is he says, where's the fact-checking when you put something in the Harvard Law Review? Okay. What Van Dyck says to Leiter, and he says, in my opinion, there was a failure at the Harvard Law Review to do fact-checking, but it was on your response to me, and here's why. Mm-hmm. He says, your facts weren't checked. So I said, I'm going to charge the Harvard Law Review with failing to observe its own policy with your reply to me, because mine complied with the laws, and they checked my facts, but they failed to check your facts when you responded to me. Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, so he's been bringing up
that he had to pass the gauntlet. Yeah. But this guy gets to criticize him without the required passing the fact-checking requirement.
It's strictly editorial, right?
Yes, but that's not how it works in the Law Review. Which even worse, because he's a professor of philosophy. And then, of course, Van Dyck tears him apart, saying, I would think that a professor of philosophy would understand the metaphysical implications of this A, B, and C, because he shows where he did all these. He says, first thing he says is, well, the ID, the Discovery Institute, which published this book, is the public relations arm of the creationist group. And, of course, they disavow each other. There's no way that this group can be the public relations arm of something, another group that wants nothing to do with them. That's not public relations. What he's simply complaining about, Leiter, is that these groups are effective in propagating something very interesting. Another point is that Leiter attacks, there's a guy with several PhDs, two PhDs in the biological sciences. But what Leiter says is the only significant thing for us to know is that man has a divinity degree in this as well, and that means that the PhDs are meaningless. So, Christians, be prepared for this possibility that if you're a Christian and identified as such, your degree will be discounted. It's going to be meaningless because you have a commitment that disqualifies you as a scientist, because you believe that rocks could come from the sky. And everyone knows rocks don't come from the sky. All rocks that we find are from the earth. So you and your sky rocks can go where you need to go. But you're not going to be publishing in our publications, because we have rocks from the earth publications only. So here's a good place to have a fight, in my view, right? Have a knockdown drag out and get these issues out. I think it's nice because Dr. Michael Behe's name came up again. Michael Behe is kind of the biggest thorn in the side among evolutionists. He's one of the world's experts on blood clotting mechanisms. And he's shown about as conclusively as anybody that you cannot get a blood clotting system in place without all the parts simultaneously existing, and there are like seven complex parts to the clotting process. And if any one of them doesn't exist, the thing either doesn't clot or it clots immediately and the creature has turned solid and there's nothing to pump through the heart because it's all the gigantic thrombus at that point, right? So these attacks on evolution are unwelcome. And so what can they do? They can't hit them on the science. So they discredit them and play the character assassination game. It's almost political at this point. In fact, we should probably say that this debate is getting almost political, because people's worldview are getting stepped on no matter what side you're on. Because there's a big gap between saying I think the Earth's 6 to 10,000 years old versus I believe it's 4.5 billion years old. These two groups are, you say, it's just a slight matter of degree. What we can? Yes.
Well, when the theory of evolution came on the scene, it was just the same thing. It took 100 years to ram that down our throats. I mean, it takes a long time to change people's minds. So I think we're at the beginning of our battle. It may take us 100 years to get the truth out.
There's some sad commentary on this whole thing. Here's the thing, the saddest. When evolution came in the door, back door of the church, if you will, the groups that fought it, tooth and nail, probably the most effective denomination that maintained a strong witness for creationism against Darwinism when it was unfashionable to do so. In other words, you paid a price in ridicule for doing so with the Seventh-day Adventists. The mainline Protestants wanted more credibility. Well, the Seventh-day Adventists didn't have much credibility, so they didn't care about going to bat for the Word of God. So some of the top scholars we had, and you cite them, you find out, oh, Slusher is Seventh-day Adventist. Oh, you know, the guy, what's his name? It'll come to me in a second. He's the one who found out that the effect of leaching on radiometric dating from limestone water and salt water coming through uranium deposits and stuff like that, and then changing the compositions as a result of leach effects, and how that affects the thing. He's also a Seventh-day Adventist. You can name, I think Patterson was too, some of these people who were publishing between 1920 and 1950. And it wasn't until the publication of the Genesis Flood, 1961, by Henry Morris and John C. Whitcomb, where a PhD in hydrology got together from Virginia with a theology Old Testament professor from Grace Theological Seminary in Winona Lake, Indiana, I think it is, and wrote this book, and they couldn't find a single publisher to publish this book on the Genesis Flood, because it defended the geology, what's called flood geology nowadays, the notion that all the strata you see were laid down extremely rapidly in the course of less than a year, and that the Grand Canyon was scoured out the way while it was still very soft sediment, so it could be done very rapidly. By the way, I told you about what happened at Mount St. Helens, right? That they have a little mini Grand Canyon, they call it. It's about 1/10 the depth of the Grand Canyon, but it was scoured out in about 2 weeks. So by uniformitarian principles, it seems that you could get the Grand Canyon in 20 weeks if you can get one-tenth of it scoured out in 2 weeks as a result of the Mount St. Helens stuff. By the way, lots of amazing things going on at Mount St. Helens. I'm surprised that the evolutionists don't bar creationists from going there. Off limits. No one's allowed here because there's too much evidence against evolution here. I mean, tons of it. The petrified rock trees that were alive in 1980, prior to the eruption, are in the lake. You know, they were petrified by the heat effect and the blast, and they are indistinguishable from the petrified forest lumber. But they say it takes a long time to get petrified trees because the process they talk about is, you know, soak it with minerals, and the minerals start to replace the natural thing. It can be done much faster than that. And they have oil developing there, too, and peat bogs.
That's funny. I've not heard that at all.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the best-kept secrets of what goes on in Mount St. Helens. Of course, one of the funnier things is the stalactites that are developed in the basement of homes in New England, you know, 7-foot stalactites. And, you know, you always say stalactite takes hundreds of thousands of years to develop. And what are they doing in the home in New England? Growing from the limestone that's taking there. I guess they can deform faster than that. But in the war of evidence, you know, it's he who has the mic. Reagan said, "This I paid for this microphone." Well, by and large, most of the microphones are there paid by evolutionists. Creationists have to fight and scrap for what little publication they can get. Since it's already ruled out that anything that points in this direction probably has to be barred from publication because it's not objective. In fact, one of Leiter's complaints about one of the three citations, he says, well, that guy's a closet intelligent design person. Okay, that's the problem. Well, he's saying, well, he got published because he's a closet one and he didn't expressly, you know, well, what about, no, wait, think about this a second. It was reviewed and refereed. The quality of the article was good for publication, but you're saying had they known he was ID, they would have barred it. But they would have barred it on something other than the quality of the article. They would have barred it on a philosophical despising of creationism in any form, including the intelligent design form, right? So it again proves Van Dyke's point about the bias and the tremendous censorship going on. That Van Dyke says the only criticism that can be made about Harvard Law Review is that they didn't censor my review. And he said, I'm sure Leiter's unhappy that they didn't, because it should have been, from Leiter's point of view. So I think that's scary that we are blocked from publishing in these things. And if we do get to be published, Leiter thinks it's because we've hidden who we are. Like we might say, well, I got two doctorates in the sciences, and you don't mention your PhD or your MDiv, your Master of Divinity degree, and that gets you in the door. But if you happen to say, I'm also an MDiv, that's all she wrote, right? Instant rejection. So who's the gatekeeper? And what is our job with respect to the gates of hell? I think the church is to see that they not prevail. So ultimately, if the church was more effective, and this is my tithe message here, the church tithed properly. And I'll tell you what that means in a minute in a controversial way. If the church tithed properly, we'd be in a very, very different position in the educational front across the country, because the best institutions would be the Christian ones. They wouldn't be ones that would be maligned as obviously fundamentalist, knee-jerk, conservative, redneck institution, you know, like Oral Roberts or Liberty University. You know, they're always discounted as, well, that's a Christian liberal arts college, so you know what that is. They're on their own little agenda, and it's not a serious degree. And if it's credential, it's probably just a concession to keep constituents happy at the home front with the senators and who knows. So they always have an excuse when that happens. You might ask, okay, Martin, why don't you fill out that comment about tithing properly? How do you tithe properly? Let me show you something very interesting about tithing. Very interesting and very controversial about tithing. Did I say it was very controversial? I meant to say it's very controversial. Let's see if I can find it here.
Is this going to be controversial?
Bet on it. I believe it's in chapter... I mentioned Nehemiah, right? All right, here we go. Nehemiah 10:37 and 38. and we turn there. And we might have to resort to this kind of strategy. And if we have some long-term thinking, we can't always count on the fact that our friends, the evolutionists, are going to suddenly say, you know, we've just been too hard on you boys. It's time for us to let bygones be bygones and stop this pointless bickering and let you publish in our scholarly journals and not throw you out just because you have an MDiv degree. Because all we're interested really is the quality of your science and not where it points. You can put all your rock and from the sky stuff in you want. Well, I don't think that's going to happen. I think there's some alternatives have to be coming up we have to work on. Anyway, this passage in Nehemiah says something very interesting. It's based on the law of God. Verse 37, and that we should bring the first fruits of our dough and our offerings and the fruit of all manner of trees of wine and of oil unto the priests, to the chambers of the house of our God, and the tithes of our ground unto the Levites, that the same Levites might have the tithes in all the cities of our tillage. And the priest, the son of Aaron, shall be with the Levites when the Levites take tithes, and the Levites shall bring up the tithe of the tithes unto the house of our God, to the chambers, into the treasure house. Treasure house is also known as the storehouse. Now, this is very interesting. I don't know how many people have seen this before. This is considered one of the most dangerous verses in all Scripture for churches. The tithe is 10% of the increase. That gets paid to the Levites. The Levites, in turn, take 10% of the 10%. And that goes to the house of God. That's a sequence. It's straight out of the Old Testament, the law of tithes. And that's why Nehemiah reinforced it and said, this is the right way to go. So the temple and everything related to with worship is down here at 1% of your income. The other 9% went to the Levitical function, which was the education of Israel. They were to seek knowledge at the priest's lip and at the Levites. They were to be the instructors. They were responsible for literacy and knowledge in the nation. So the tithe was fundamentally an educational thing, because only a fraction, tithe of the tithe, went to institutional worship. What happens nowadays is the following. Institutional worship. Two things happen. Two sad things happen. First thing is, what I'm interested in, is that essentially the entire tithe goes here. And then the kids go to public school. Is it any wonder that the kids go to public school? Because this has been defunded completely. Few churches have associated schools with them of various qualities and commitments to Scripture. You can have a church school that's teaching evolution, trust me. Or socialism. Happens all the time in all the Catholic schools in South America, they don't teach anything but socialism and evolution there in the name of Christ. I don't see how you do that, but they do it. So what happens is that this gets defunded, and this thing gets bloated over here. So we take away and misdistribute the tithe to where it doesn't belong and put it over here. So then this becomes the core of the nation, and this gets defunded, and now the state becomes the educator, as happens in most countries. So that's the first sad thing, is that we misdistribute the tithe. But now here's what happens. American Christians don't give this much. They're down around 2.5%. Then that goes down there. So it's a vicious circle, isn't it? There's less faithfulness because what? The teaching that the Levites were to be was to be in the Lord, after the fear of the Lord. Levites weren't to teach secular subjects. There was no such thing as a secular subject from a biblical worldview. Every subject is God's subject. Okay? So you lose sight of the tithe, and people then would be tithing less, and what they do tithe goes to the wrong place. Now, if you tell pastors they're overpaid, they could tell you you're crazy. And in some sense, yeah, because they're not overpaid. But the institutional church is absorbing a part of the tithe that doesn't have a right to, And then the worst of it is when pastors preach out of Malachi 3 about robbing God. The famous passage, you rob tithe God by in your tithes and offerings, and therefore you, and all pastors like to preach about it. You get a hole in your purse, and you, that's why you're not doing well, it's because you're robbing God. Bring God the tithe into God's storehouse, and then God will unleash these blessings upon you. All true. But then they equate God's storehouse here and bypass that. And that's not the storehouse of God. The storehouse of God was to deliver it to the Levites, and the Levites in turn then tithed to the faithful institution. It was, in fact, you know, people say, well, it's the church. We get into churchianity, and that's dangerous to say that the kingdom of God is restricted to the institutional church. I assure you that it was legitimate, and scriptures condone the delivering of tithes to Elisha and the prophets out in the wilderness when they had absolutely nothing to do with the temple worship. The storehouse of God was not located there despite the fact there was institutional worship there. It proves the storehouse is not there. The storehouse is where the Levitical ministry is located. Levitical ministries are the educational ministries. Does the Sunday school class form part of that? Yes, it does. Admittedly, inside the institutional church is a ministry of teaching. But is it, I believe it's far bigger than that. And I'm glad that we have the opportunities like this, and then these other classrooms are being used to teach. But 1 hour a week versus what happens out there, you think that cuts the mustard? I don't. Do you think so? Woefully inadequate. Woefully inadequate because the money's going the wrong place and there's not enough of it. If American Christians really took 10% of their money and gave 9% of their money to Christian education and 1% to the institutional church, both would be a lot healthier. We just can't envision what that would look like. It's so far removed from our thinking. But if you redo the educational system, you can get in some very interesting positions. I'll give you my College of a University model, I think is very fascinating. Some very rich Christian, that's a big if, right? If some very rich Christian decided to endow, fully endow a college, a university, brand new, and he did it the following way. Top-notch, huge amount of land, beautiful environment, and he acquires a faculty by paying 2 or 3 times what they're getting somewhere else. So he picks out the best of the faculty across the entire world, and he entices them with tenure and much more money than they're paying. So he pays the bill to have the best, and they're all committed to Reformed theology. That's a prerequisite. So you get the best in their fields, in the sciences, the mathematics, and engineering, and law, sociology, the works, medicine. You build it. And then you do the next thing, which just totally stupefies the competition, if you will. Tuition is zero, but we pick who comes in. So you get a full free ride. And if the tax authorities say, well, that's a gift that's worth something, says, we'll pay it. We'll pay for students to be here. If you say that student's getting $10,000 worth of education and he owes $3,000 taxes, we'll pay the $3,000. So he's got $13,000 now, we'll pay the tax on that until it's already blown out. So that nobody's denied coming there, and now it becomes the most desirable university in the world. People are going to fight and scratch to get into that thing, and its credentials are going to go through the roof, because it's going to have the best faculty, that the students fight to get in. And then you do something that most people don't realize. You make the school self-funding. How do you do that? Because you go to the engineering school and say, you know, you guys, every patent that you guys get, one of the conditions of you being here is that 10% of the royalties from that stuff comes back to the school. So they have an incentive because they get to keep it. I don't know if you know, when I went to college at Harvey Mudd, and it's true for still almost universities, if I develop or create or invent something at Harvey Mudd University, College of Science and Engineering, my school student paper says it belongs to the college. It doesn't matter if I did it drunk in a dorm room on a Saturday night. It's theirs, right? I was never drunk in a dorm room. I've never been drunk at all, in fact, but it's because I don't drink, but I've been around lots of drunks in dorm rooms on Saturday nights, so I know what that's like, and it's very inventive, I think. Very inventive environment, especially at Harvey Mudd. But you're not allowed to keep it, you know, and this is what we call muzzling the ox again. You know, they created it, but they get no right to it, and even though you're paying lots of money to go to Harvey Mudd, anything that you think up while you're there doesn't belong to you. Well, here we share the fruits of labor. They get to keep the majority of it in this kind of an institution, and the rest goes to the college. Then you say, okay, we want the architecture school of architecture school to plan out the construction of the rest of the build of the university and the fleshing out of the university. And we want the engineering school to develop new materials for the building of the rest of the thing. And we want the law school to do all the patent work and the litigation for this thing. And so you make it self-sustaining. And it's very soon, I figure, in 4 or 5 years, the thing doesn't need the endowment anymore. And then it's off and running. And now that institution can publish anything it doggone well pleases, and it'll be respected and heard. Because now it's played the game in a way that the, you know, you don't know this. Maybe you do. How many, anyone know how much the Princeton Endowment is? How much it covers of tuition? All of it. They don't need your tuition. Your tuition's already covered when you go to Princeton. So that enormous $16,000 a year that they charge is over, it's gravy, it's off the top. They could do that and have the students in for free and still make money. They're just greedy. This university that I would propose is different. It honestly is zero. They don't need the money. They're going to keep it that way. So everything's done on a scholarship. And we don't kowtow to government grants for this stuff because there's no necessity for a government grant if it's a free education. But you invest a lot in it up front to get a tremendous fruit out the backside. And then people would be more inclined to start thinking along this line on top. So that we can invade the evolutionists on their own territory with a high-power institution that's not merely a liberal arts college. Why am I down on liberal arts colleges? I'll tell you why. There's a lot of strong defense of Christian liberal arts, saying the Christian man should be well-rounded and have all these subjects in his purview, and that's fine. That's all and good, well and good. But you know something what that does? That evacuates Christian effectiveness in the sciences and the law and things like this. And so we're not taking every thought captive. We're taking like a general overview, the general ed kind of thing. The liberal arts degree. I think it has its place. But if we're not also simultaneously creating the best physicists, the best chemists, the best engineers, the best lawyers, the best doctors, the best surgeons, we've got a problem. The best computer designers and programmers. Why not have the best? Why doesn't Christ Church have the best in these areas? Why isn't it at least inculcating the possibility for that rather than helping undermine it by redirecting the thought? He can't even get there till he starts something like this, I think. Unless some visionary millionaire decides.